Hello and welcome to this episode of the Nothing Ventured Primer with me, Arish Shah. Today in the studio with me, I am super excited to have Egosa Onwigwe. Egosa is managing partner at Echo VC, a seed and early stage technology VC investing in underrepresented founders and underserved markets with a focus on Africa, Europe, and the US. Prior to setting up Echo, Egosa spent close to a decade at Intel Capital in various roles, but ultimately investing in consumer internet and semantic tech. Egosa splits his time between Lagos, London, and New York. Egosa, it's great to have you here in the studio with me.
Thank you. Very happy to be here.
Excellent. So let's get straight into the primer. For our audience, could you take us through kind of your resume and how you got into venture? I know it's a pretty complicated story, but I think it's a pretty exciting one.
Sure, absolutely. So my history actually starts back in Nigeria. I was born there and raised there. So I went to high school and college and law school there, and practiced for a couple of years as a corporate and oil and gas lawyer, and then moved to the United States to do a law and corporate finance degree at the University of Pennsylvania. And that's sort of where my United States history starts. And then, you know, we went our way through a bunch of different experiences, worked at a medical technology startup, exited that, went to a consulting firm, then actually went back into the practice of law for a little while, and then decided, you know, for some random reason that I wanted to start a company. You know, I got the buzz, I think. Either it was sort of the Yahoo Times or the Google Times, but I got the buzz, you know, to start a business-to-business enterprise company. And I got my first lesson in how important timing is, because I started that business in March 2000. I think it may have been a week before the NASDAQ crash, or maybe it was 4 days before the NASDAQ crash, yeah. One or the other. And so, you know, tried to run that as best as I could, but, you know, ran out of funding, and then got recruited into Intel Capital. And that was sort of the start of I think the most amazing stage of my career. Went into Intel Capital, first of all, as part of the, portfolio management group. This was sort of at the very end of 2000, beginning of 2001. Mm. And that group was tasked with managing Intel Capital's portfolio, which is quite large. It was probably 300 plus companies. And we did that. And as part of the process of managing these companies, I realized a few things. One was, and remember, this was 2001. Lots of companies were shutting down. Yeah. Lots of companies were shutting down. And so, you know, one of the things that, you know, I realized was that there was a really big opportunity to potentially acquire the intellectual property from these companies. And so I started a patent purchase group back then, which then turned out to be a monster-sized...
So kind of like a distress fund, essentially.
That's pretty much
right?
It. Yeah, yeah. Right. But looking for patents.
Yeah.
Right. And you know, this was a sort of a cross team group, and that turned out to be a really excellent initiative. And then as part of that, you know, really sort of, you know, kickstarted bankruptcy and restructuring activity. Mm-hmm. And this was also to support the wind downs of Intel Capital portfolio companies, but eventually, you know, that extended to the business units who started reaching out looking for help in supporting wind downs of suppliers. And so I became the bankruptcy and restructuring guru, the patent purchasing guru. And I was like, this is such a strange evolution of my career. But what eventually turned out was that two things. One was that I actually really wanted to get into the investing side of the house. Mm. And that was partially because as part of the entree into deciding to be an entrepreneur back in 2000, I had stumbled on the semantic web and started to sort of learn a lot about it and got very excited about its prospects. This was, you know, sort of 1999. For those who are doing the math, you know, the semantic web that's just about coming true now.
Which we will no doubt talk about. But I mean, okay, so for our listeners, back in those days, what would you consider semantic web?
So that was essentially the web of meaning.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, what Google did, you know, right around the same time was sort of build a structure around page rank. So the weight of interest.
Yeah.
Right. But what the semantic web did was essentially to extrapolate that one level and said, okay, so what does this mean? Where this piece of content and what is its relevance to me and how could I use it to do X or Y, right? And so when you're now looking at things like generative AI, you're really seeing, you know, first and second order applications of the semantic web. Still more to come because I think that's what, you know, AGI, artificial general intelligence, actually does. But this was back, you know, in the early 2000s. And so with that as a backdrop, I really wanted to get into investing. I looked around, you know, and I saw sort of two things. One was that I did not have any background, you know, from what I saw that was going to be able to make me attractive to venture capital. Mm. One was, you know, I didn't have an operator's background. Sure, I'd run a startup for a little while, but, you know, I've never sort of dared to think that that was going to make me an operator. And I hadn't done sales. I hadn't done marketing. I was just, you know, a lawyer doing interesting things. And so I decided to go to business school. And the truth was that I got into business school because I realized that, you know, having an MBA was not necessarily going to open doors, but would prevent doors from being shut.
And would create network and relationships, essentially.
Correct.
Yeah.
Right. And so, of course, you know, you're in the valley, you know, it's me, I have an odd accent, I'm black, I don't have an MBA. You know, there were lots of things that, you know, could have created sort of a coefficient of drag. And so I said, hey, you know what, we're going to do something different. And I decided to go to school. But, you know, I made a fundamental error, I think, which was that I went back to school a little bit late.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So by the time I decided to go back to the MBA, I had sort of gotten enough career traction where the opportunity cost of the MBA was extremely high.
Yeah.
Right. So you're not sort of coming as an undergrad, you're making 40 grand or 50 grand, you know, you have to give up, you know, that, right? You know, it was quite the opportunity cost. So I made a decision that, you know, the only way I was going to do the MBA was to see if I could find one that would allow me to do it full-time. But I didn't want to do an executive MBA.
Mm.
So I eventually did a full-time, fully employed MBA, which was absolutely brutal. You know, I always tell folks that if there was one thing I learned during that period, it was that life is a series of trades.
Yeah.
And for every trade, you have to be very clear about the, you know, both the upside and the downside.
There's always opportunity costs, right?
Yes, yeah. There's always a cost. And so sometimes an opportunity cost and sometimes just a cost.
Yeah.
Right. And so I did that, and for some very interesting reason, and you know, in having this conversation, I thinking back to sort of the evolution of my career and how there's a fair amount of it that is, you know, stuff that you actively work to create. And then there's a lot of it that is just absolutely pure luck. And so, you know, I look back to sort of probably the most significant influence on my career was my old boss, who was the Intel treasurer at that point in time, who became president of Intel Capital, and is probably maybe the smartest guy I've ever met. And I mean, I've never seen a brain that works, you know, just, you know, parallel processing at its very best. And so, you know, what was interesting was that when I had joined Intel, I met him or was introduced to him simply because we shared one love, which is cars. And we became buddies because of cars, a shared love of cars. And what was interesting was when I got the opportunity to become his chief of staff, 3.5 years later, what I wasn't aware was that for that entire 3.5 years, I was being interviewed.
Like a very long term try before you buy.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. So a lot of it was just not just about my ability to sort of execute, but also how to think, how to be intellectually curious and the like. So that sort of has worked out. And so, you know, I then moved from where I was to become chief of staff for Intel Treasury, which is also quite a jump because that was a group that had a bunch of MBAs and CFAs, right, and or CPAs. Yeah. I had none of those at that point in time, right? And so there was a lot of imposter syndrome. But he believed in me and thought I could do it. Now, what became interesting was as an adjunct to my interest in the semantic web, you know, when I became chief of staff, you know, I had been looking around the valley and this was when Web 2.0 was coming out, you know, and I was like, whoa, this is interesting, right? We should be doing more about
it. So this is like the generation of the Facebooks
The you know, six aparts, you know, it was Blogger, there was, you know, I mean, eventually it became sort of Twitter and Jaiku and the like. And so Odeo, right? So there was so much going on. And then Mike Arrington with TechCrunch, you know, and Om Malik. So a lot of that crew, there was a lot of activity and there's a lot of excitement. So I went back to my boss then and I said, look, we need to sort of really sort of think about restarting consumer internet investing. And so we did. We put that together. And so I was, of course, out there building out networks, you know, bringing a bunch of things. And so this was also partially the reason why I then went back to him, you know, and I think it was 2005 or so thereabouts, and said, I think we should actually do something slightly different as a corporate investor, which is probably look to bring very large checks to bear for maybe the top 10, 15 internet companies globally. And so he was like, okay, you know, what do you suggest? And so I then, you know, started bringing in some very interesting companies. And I had to chase all of them down. You know, Facebook, I mean, missed YouTube, but Facebook and a whole bunch of them. And the truth was that at that point in time, Intel Capital didn't have that kind of brand.
Yeah.
Right. So I was essentially...
It wasn't a traditional VC as such, right?
Yeah. No. So I was essentially selling myself and my conviction, backed with a, you know, big balance sheet type of investor. But I was fortunate enough to get in with these founders and convince them that, you know, we were the right partner of choice. And so from, you know, 2007, brought in pretty much every top-notch firm you had. I mean, there was a point in time, I don't know whether it was 6, 8, 9 months straight, where we would have IC meetings every Tuesday, and I was on the calendar every Tuesday. It was insane. But what was, I think, most frustrating was a lot of those companies, you needed to be able to see them not the way they were, but the way they were going to be, right? And, you know, as a traditional investor, Intel Capital was, you know, they knew semis, they knew a bunch of things, but this consumer internet was still a little
early
out there.
And I mean, we'll talk about this in the main podcast, but I think the way you described it is you have to be contrarian, but you have to be right.
Correct.
So yeah, it's about understanding where the future is going rather than where it is today.
Correct.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it was kind of interesting because there's, you know, I remember distinctly, you know, when we're bringing those deals in, you know, Facebook was one we brought in 2007. I was supposed to lead that deal, the one with Microsoft. We were going to have 260 million. Microsoft was going to have 240. Eventually, Microsoft did the 240. But it was odd because no one ever asked, that's a weird number. Why would you do the 240? It was a $500 million round, and I was supposed to do the 260 because, you know, for a variety of reasons, they were more comfortable with us taking the majority of that round.
Yeah, taking the lead on that.
Right. Yeah. And you know, but there was a lot of trepidation about, you know, how's this company ever going to make money and so on and so forth. But I think the proudest moment, I think when I brought that deal in, was essentially telling, this was September 2007, essentially telling the IC that this company was going to be worth $100 billion on or before 2014. 7 years or less, right? And it was 100.
There or thereabouts, yeah. Yeah.
And you know, and I, you know, and it was a, would have been a really good, interesting investment, you know, $260 million at a $10 billion valuation. And, you know, but what was sort of interesting was when we brought in some other deals over the next few years, you know, Facebook, LinkedIn, Pandora, but we never got any of those deals done, right? For a variety of reasons, you know, and, you know, and, you know, you, as an investor, you think about sort of regrets and the like, because, you know, some one or two more of those deals would have sort of changed trajectories. But at the same time, you know, you do get the lesson, which is you don't just have to be contrarian and right. You have to have the capital backing those two things,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so I stayed there for until 2010, Intel Capital, and decided that I wanted to go start my own thing. And so I left, puttered around for a few months, and then, you know, sort of started to build my thesis for what I thought was next. And what was next was essentially a realization that I had picked up at Intel, which was that, you know, one of the other things I really don't sort of talk about in my background is that I also covered consumer internet for India, you know, and the like. And one of the things Intel, it's huge lesson, huge gratitude on my part for that, was teaching everybody that worked there how opportunity was, you know, really existed globally. You know, by the time I left, I think Intel Capital were in 34 countries, right? So it was crazy because it essentially showed you that you could find, you know, technology and entrepreneurs powering technology, you know, platforms everywhere. And so when I left, you know, the one thing that sort of struck me was that there was so much excitement about China, for instance. And I had kind of learned how to figure out how to look when no one else was looking, right? What did I, back then, what I used to call open air secrets? Where were the open air secrets? And in my view, there were sort of two geographies. One was Southeast Asia and the other was Africa. And, you know, and again, because you're also thinking in sort of 10, 15-year spans, you know, you're really thinking, okay, what do these geographies look like in 10 or 15 years?
Yeah.
And you take sort of a view on that, and then you still go start executing. So I went out to try to raise money for that strategy, which is, you know, investing in these sort of underserved markets and, you know, I'm bringing sort of the Silicon Valley approach. So I used to call it the triangle offense, right? The base was the valley, and then the two sides were Africa and Southeast Asia. And I absolutely got my butt handed to me because everybody was like, and by the way, you have to sort of think about this. I had never raised money, right? Because at Intel Capital, your money was down the corridor, right? You just go to Treasury, right? But this was the first time I had tried to go raise money, and I had no idea what I was doing, none whatsoever. And so, you know, some very kind person, and I got a lot of pushback. You know, I still remember someone who told me that he was very disappointed in my decision to go chase these markets, and it didn't show a lot of sort of judgment.
Jeez.
And I mean, I've not reached out to him since then because I would, you know, love to point out to him, so look at these markets today and tell me how you're thinking about it.
Yeah.
But you have to be good with being wrong, and you have to be good with being right. And so, but, you know, some kind LP told me no one's ever going to fund this strategy because no one understands it. It doesn't fit.
Mm.
Right. And so that's when I also learned how to be plain vanilla, right? Which is kind of strange because when you want to be contrarian and right, it means by definition your strategy is not going to be plain vanilla. And so eventually I just, you know, I took the feedback from the market. And market was like, well, pick one of these geographies and raise something small and figure it out. So I picked Africa, raised a small fund back in 2014. And you know, it took me like 2.5 years to raise this fund and just started investing. And over that time, we expanded sort of our thesis to really sort of focus, again, open air secrets, as part of sort of our learning process, learning by shipping, as Steve Sinofsky would say, and learning by doing, also realized that the biggest open air secret was not these geographies, but was underrepresented entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
Right. So women, you know, Latinos, you know, blacks and the like. And I was like, okay, so this is really interesting. No one is doing this. And, you know, a lot of sort of my investing history has always been trying to get to things that people don't see. Right. And so, I was like, well, no one's seen that. Right. And so sort of shift our investment thesis around underrepresented entrepreneurs and underserved markets. And the underrepresented entrepreneurs element of it is very clear, but the underserved markets, I think, tends to confuse a lot of people.
So we're going to talk about that, I think, in quite some detail, actually, on the main podcast. So if you think about Echo VC, what is the fund size? Like, where do you invest? Because underrepresented founders, underserved markets is like global, like essentially, right?
It is.
So how do you think about what you know, where are you investing? What sort of stages, what sort of companies, and what sort of check size?
Sure. So when we first started, we raised a $16.5 million fund.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, interesting story along the way. We got defaulted on twice.
Yep. By so, LPs.
Yes.
Yep.
So that was interesting in a not so interesting way. And then along the way, we got into a strategic partnership with TPG Growth to do what they call small checks for them.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did a couple of investments for them. And so today, you know, and, you know, we've kind of evolved. You know, so one of the things we kind of realized along the way was that we were, I think, quite skeptical that a typically sort of normal size Series A fund, you know, whether it's 150 million, 200 million, you know, focus on, say, Africa alone, was going to be very difficult to return.
Mm-hmm.
And so what our strategy sort of evolved into was building what we call small footprint vehicles,
mm-hmm.
And then building sort of a larger Series A vehicle. So we've raised a seed fund, small seed fund. So these are all sort of sub $15 million mm-hmm. funds. We've raised a blockchain fund. And we're about to announce another one, another sort of very specific, you know, vertical focused one, and they're all sub 15, and the goal is to then, you know, because with that, we, you know, the portfolio construction tells us that we can return those funds much easier. But then you also now take a lot of the risk out. So when you're going into the Series A fund, which is we're also raising, which is a $75 million fund, you're actually taking less risk, but the upside remains.
Yeah.
And so that's the current strategy. Our total AUM right now is about 70 million.
Okay.
We have returned in cash about 21 of it.
You know what? You're the first guest I've had on who I think has explicitly told us how much they've actually returned. So kudos, because at least we know the fund is performing.
Yeah, exactly. It happens. Yeah. And for the listeners, you know, a lot of and we'll probably talk about in the main section. But one of the biggest challenges I think VC firms face today is that the performance and the narrative, there's a mismatch.
Yep.
Right. So when, you know, in the frothy 20s, I like to call it.
I'm old enough to remember those. Yeah.
Right. lots of people, you know, were running around with 7, 8, 14X funds on paper.
Mm.
And I still remember because of the way we are very, I think we're very disciplined about our marks.
Mm.
We were at sort of like 4X.
So theoretically underperforming, but...
No, we're told we're underperforming.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we're like, you know, people are like, well, we've seen funds that are 9. Mm. You know, why are you guys? And I was like, I don't know. I've been around the block. And so now even, we've been very fortunate. We have a very small handful of impairments. We're still in the same region,
mm-hmm.
right? And we don't have, a huge number of, super exciting companies. But we do have companies that are, you know, going from 3 million to 30 in revenues. So that, and they're not raising.
Yeah, they don't need to raise.
They don't
which
need
is,
to
and,
raise.
And this is, and this is the, you know, the dirty secret of venture is, I guess, that the best companies are the companies that don't need the additional capital, right? Like, or they can raise the capital on their own terms. So let's talk about some of those companies. If you were to, think about sort of three within the portfolio that you're super excited about, or even outside of the portfolio, what companies would those be and why?
So we I think I always think about an interesting statement that Michael Moritz, Sir Michael Moritz said, who's former chairman of Sequoia, when he said that, you know, a lot of venture is about finding the oddly complected bird in the flock. Right. And the truth of the matter is that, you know, the flock is flying in the dark.
Mm.
So for you to find the oddly complected bird, you actually need to have night vision goggles. Right. And we don't have night vision goggles, but what we have is sort of the source of the name of the fund, Echo VC. We use sound. Right. And, you know, it's sonar.
Signals. Yeah.
Right. And so it signals. Yeah. Right. And so, you know, when we look at our portfolio, there's 67 companies in total.
Wow.
That we've invested in. And, you know, so when you're asking the top three, it's like, oh, who are my favorite kids?
Yeah.
But I, what I could sort of share is, you know, I'll give you sort of examples of companies that, you know, I mean, we're proud of them. But some of them, I think, are what I'll call sort of globally paradigm shifting type companies.
Mm-hmm.
So the first one people have heard me talk about is a company called Grow Intelligence. And so it's also an AI company, but lots of people don't actually recognize this one because they've never bandied themselves as an AI company, but it's AI top to bottom. And Grow is led by an Ethiopian entrepreneur called Sarah Menka. Mm-hmm. And I led the series six years ago. Mm-hmm. And what they built is a platform that does sort of two things, you know, at scale. One is the ability to bring AI to improve your knowledge and analytics for food security data.
Yeah.
So ag and food security data. And they've done that, you know, across the globe. And then, you know, the other thing they've done is using that same, you know, platform to bring analytics and knowledge to climate and climate mm-hmm. risk. All right, so they're the largest platform in the world that does this. You won't see them on any
You've
of
never
the
have heard of them.
Lists,
yeah.
whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah.
But they're the largest platform in the world. I don't know if I'm allowed to say how many models they have, but it's in the seven figures.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And you know, and what they've built is absolutely is magic.
And correct me if I'm wrong. This company has 80 trillion data points. Is that right?
Oh, so what they do on a daily basis? Yeah. I think it's 700 or 800 a day.
Wow.
Something, it's some mad number.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very large platform. And you know, and Sarah is such a self-deprecating founder because, you know, she'll say random things like, I don't remember, you know, everybody's, you know, concerned about the size of the platform and, you know, she'd be like, yeah, you know, our cloud bill goes down every month and it's now sort of in the 30s.
So they basically have economies of scale as they scale up, their compute costs plummet. Wow.
That's how well engineered
the golden dream. Yeah,
yes,
yeah,
the
exactly.
platform is. Yeah, yeah. You know, and I tease her like, you know, you need to spin this thing out. These are your AI tools that manage all this data.
Yeah.
But you know, that's, you know, it's a remarkable business and you know, and I've always sort of said that, you know, there are certain segments that have TAMs that are essentially the global population, you know, food. I mean, that's it, right? I mean, food is every day, right?
Yep.
You know, and, you know, people say, well, what about money? I'm like, you know, there are places where there's no real money. You can trade by barter.
Yep.
But food, yeah, that's
not a
high
single person on the planet.
Right?
Like, not
that's a high dependency, you know, TAM. And so that's one that I think we are unbelievably excited about and continue to be incredibly bullish. A second one, I think, which is also interesting, and you know, we have a very high percentage of folks who are teams in a portfolio that are women-led. Mm-hmm. And so when we talk about, you know, our portfolio, we're very proud. We're not a gender-specific fund,
sure,
but we've always sort of been, you know, very inclusive about sort of how we think about investing. But there's another one we really like. Again, a complete secret, led by a founder called Uju, and she's sole founder, mm-hmm, as well. And so when I talk about a lot of sort of the narratives, you know, we have some very, very high-performing companies that are solo founder-led.
Yep.
And so Uju built a platform called Traders of Africa. Mm-hmm. It's a marketplace. And essentially, it's multi-country, designed for to bring buyers and sellers of commodities.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Wow.
It's a very simple-looking business.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, she's built... It's really incredible, just incredible. And what's even more incredible is that she's raised $100,000.
$100,000.
That's it. that's it, right? And seven figures, trying to get to eight this year, like eight, not like near eight, like eight.
Yeah.
Right. And you're thinking, okay, that's impressive, right? And again, breaking the narrative, right? Mm. So, you know, what folks call a narrative violation, and those are interesting. Then the third company I think that I would probably pick right off the bat is, interesting, yet another woman-led company.
That's three for three, yeah.
I've been very clear even on Twitter that our best performing fund returners will be women-led.
Which I think, well, I mean, and again, I don't have the statistics, but actually the statistics bear that out. Typically, like, female-led.
Oh, we're 100% confident of it. Our fund returns are women-led.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is another company in Nigeria led by a woman called Temi. It's Life Bank. And it was why this company was interesting to us, and we looked at it several times before we actually decided to invest in it, was that a lot of African entrepreneurs have to build what we call full-stack businesses.
Yeah.
Right? So there's a lot of the stuff that you can depend on in other markets.
Yeah.
You know, logistics, so on and so forth. You can just bring in an API.
Yeah.
You know, that's not how it works, yeah, right? So you have to build sort of an end-to-end business. And what she did was realize that some of the most important elements of a healthcare network, like the supply elements, like oxygen or blood, were not actually networked,
mm-hmm,
right? And so what you would find, you know, in the real world was, someone has an accident, is getting rushed to the hospital, right? And his or her family, their first job is to come on Twitter begging people for blood.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, see it in Kenya all the time.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Come and meet my family at this hospital. We need blood and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
So what she built was a platform that essentially allowed the networking for access of that.
Amazing.
And what was fascinating was that, you know, we are very big fans of what we call daily habit businesses, right? And you know, I wouldn't necessarily say blood and oxygen, you know, comprise daily habits. I mean, certainly oxygen does, but the demand, it's never, those are two things that you don't have to go create demand for, right?
There's always going to be someone needing.
That's it. Yeah, so you just have to figure out how to go meet the demand where it is.
Yeah.
Right. And so those are three companies. I mean, we have a whole bunch of them, you know, June at Senga, who's doing some fantastic work in logistics in Kenya. She's also amazing. Yeah. Again, another female founder,
yeah.
You know, so this is not to say that we don't have male founder led businesses that are super interesting. We do.
Yeah.
But it is, I think, an important signal that, you know, the types of businesses we look for are never sexy when we do them, but they are long-term businesses.
And they're transformational,
right,
by the sounds
and,
of it.
Yeah. And what you have to figure out is, and they can be quite difficult to fundraise for,
mm-hmm,
right? Follow-on fundraising can be quite difficult because they're never the hottest thing. They don't build on, you know...
They're not 15-minute grocery.
No, yeah. They're not high growth momentum. They're not, right? But if you stick around and you support the founders, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years later, you know, you're looking at, you know, $500 million, billion-dollar revenue business, and you're wondering, where did that all come from?
Yeah.
Right? And so I think, you know, for us, you know, we'll continue to show that knitting. We have some, you know, there's a little bit of frustration, I think, for us as well on the fundraising side, not just for the, our companies, but for our fund, because a lot of folks are looking for, it's, I guess, let me put it this way. In the last couple of years, I've been quite vocal about how venture had been broken, mm-hmm. right? People had gotten lost,
yep.
right?
A lot of tourists, a lot of...
Just crazy. This was not venture,
yeah.
right? People started assuming that building material and defining companies was easy, right? And then building material companies was all about getting follow-on rounds. You know, a friend of mine was saying about somebody else who raised 3 times in a year, right? And, you know, and I was just like, I've never seen this loss of discipline. And then we also got a sort of an entire coterie of founders who were getting zero or very poor feedback mm-hmm. from the investors, mm-hmm. right? You couldn't, you know, you had to sort of be, in quotes, founder-friendly. So in other words, never tell them what they were doing wrong, you know, just keep quiet and essentially beg them to get into the cap table. That was never venture.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, when Reid Hoffman on LinkedIn called me one morning and said, okay, I've just got out of a board meeting, the round is yours. People were like, oh, how did you do that? Not knowing that I chased after him for 9 months. Mm. I would email him. He would ghost me. Then I will convince him to come visit. I'll come visit for 9 months.
This is at LinkedIn, presumably, yes. before they exited.
Yeah. 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 And, you know, when he now said, hey, the round's yours, no one saw the work that got put in, mm-hmm. right? So it wasn't me tweeting, you know, some inane, you know, thing and saying, oh, yeah, I love my founders. You know, look, venture is a collaboration business, mm-hmm. right? It is one where people have to understand that there's some risk sharing that needs to happen, right? You work with the founder. And I'm so grateful for my Intel stint because there were just things you pick up at Intel, right? Constructive feedback was a very important element of it, right? Disagree and commit was a very important element. So you tell the founders, here's what I think, but the company's yours to run, right? And if you know, what I want to be able to see is you synthesize the information you get, then you make the decision. And even if I disagree, I disagree, but I'll commit to supporting you through that. And there's never and I told you so, because that's never helpful. But, you know, you're always thinking about that. And then also thinking about risk.
Yeah.
Right. And so we've had this sort of internal conversation internally recently about what does the Echo VC product look like? What does it mean? What should it mean, right, to founders, right? And the truth is, you know, for a long time I was taking flack because – you know, I was the one saying the emperor has no clothes. I'm sure there were a few others, you know, certainly Vinod was one. And now we're in a place where, you know, lots of people are saying quietly, well, I guess you were right. I win no prizes for being right, right? The real question now is that there's so much damage.
Yeah. How do we come back?
How do
that?
We get out of it?
Yeah.
There's so much damage. A lot of it is latent.
Yeah.
Right.
But we're going to see. I mean, I think over the next 12 months, we'll see a lot of that damage coming out. Because businesses are just going to go under. All those markdowns are going to happen. All those write-offs are going to happen. LPs are going to be basically sat there with no returns.
Yeah.
And, you know, all of a sudden that will also further kind of, I guess, send a shock through the market in terms of if you're then trying to raise new funds.
Yeah. I mean, I think some people are playing a slightly different game, especially the GPs, because they're saying, look, I can hold off on the write-downs.
Yep.
And if the stock market comes back, then, you know, then maybe I can sort of do that. But the truth of the matter is that, you know, the stock market is horrendous, right? I mean, I was reading somewhere that 15 companies are driving the S&P 500.
Yeah.
15.
Yeah.
I'm like, let me see. If I remember correctly, the S&P 500 is 500. You know, so how is that? So I don't know what's going on, yeah. right? And, you know, and instead of people sort of biting the bullet and taking the hard lumps, you know, and unfortunately, what also happens is that the market is really, really, really just topsy-turvy today.
Yeah.
You know, there's really almost no investing. Mm. My favorite metaphor, someone on Twitter was saying, another investor I really respect, Jason Lemkin, was saying that the Series A, B, and C markets are just slow. Mm. And some other investors said, oh, no. Slow I get. This is like an abandoned mall. I was like, that's Series A, B, and C, you know. And the metaphor of an abandoned mall was quite funny. But I think it really captured where we are today.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it hurts a lot of founders.
Yeah.
But, you know, I also have some very, you know, very sort of controversial takes about it. I think, you know, half of the founders out there starting businesses should not start a business. They should be working.
Yeah.
You should have jobby jobs. You know, and then, you know, we need to figure out the other half, whether or not they can create material change.
Yep.
So it is, you know, today where we are, you know, we continue to invest our little money. We continue to fundraise. That this fundraising market has definitely slowed. But the truth of the matter is that, you know, because we never sort of fell for the excessive hype, occasionally we did, you know, not necessarily FOMO, but more like price. Kind of lost our heads on some of the price discipline. But, you know, that said, I think we're still very happy with the founders and the portfolio.
Amazing. I mean, we're going to get into a lot of detail on some of this in the main pod, but Egosa, it's been great having you here with me to record this primer.
Thank you very much.